Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and welcome to Next Question. Today, we once again are dedicating our full attention to the coronavirus pandemic, which continues to spread across the country, growing at alarming rates in the most populated areas. In fact, on Friday, March 20th, the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, marked a distressing new milestone.
I hate to say this, but it's true. We are now the epicenter of this crisis.
New York State has nearly half of the nation's coronavirus cases, and the number is growing faster than anyone predicted. As of this recording, the positive COVID-19 count in New York City is doubling every 3 days. Here's Governor Andrew Cuomo on March 24th.
One of the forecasters said to me, we were looking at a freight train coming across the country. We're now looking at a bullet train because the numbers are going up that quickly.
What that means is that the peak of coronavirus infections will be much higher and hit New York much sooner than expected, giving the city's vast network of hospitals, which are already under tremendous strain, less time to prepare, less time to get the critical equipment they need to care for those patients, and less time to replenish their stash of protective gear so that medical staff can continue to work without getting sick. Which leads to my next question. How are emergency rooms in New York City faring now, and how are they bracing for what's to come? And later on, what could have been done to allow us to be better prepared for this pandemic? But first, hi, Rob.
Yes, hi.
Hi, it's Katie. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Oh, my God. Thank you for taking time to do this. Dr. Robert Femia is the chair of emergency medicine at NYU Langone in New York City. In that role, he's in charge of the emergency departments of several NYU hospitals across the metropolitan area.
We see about 500,000 patients in all of our emergency departments across Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Long Island. And we've seen a couple of consistent things. One, overall, at the majority of our emergency departments, the volume is down, but we have a huge spike in the number of respiratory cases that are serious, requiring intubation. And that number seems to be growing every day. I get a report every 12 hours from our emergency department's shift report. One of our ADs yesterday, in a 12-hour period, intubated 7 patients and put them on ventilators. That's a huge number for one 12-hour period of time. And then, you know, we have variability. The next day it might be 1 or 2. The next day it might be 6 or 7 again. So there's capacity right now. But everyone's trying to figure out how do you make sure that there's capacity down the road. To help with some of this, we stood up a 24-hour-a-day video visit telemedicine, where now we're seeing 1,000 visits on the telemedicine platform, trying to keep people off the subways, from spreading disease, giving them advice, and keeping them out of the emergency departments. So we have seen some good impact there, where our overall ED volume is down for people that are not seriously ill, but we have seen a huge spike in the number of people who are very sick and needing to be put on ventilators.
Well, let's first talk about the telemedicine patients, Rob, you're seeing. Basically, they need to know if their symptoms are serious enough to go to the hospital, if they in fact have COVID-19. In most of those cases, are you able to encourage them to in fact stay at home and to self-quarantine?
We have. One of the things with the telemedicine visits that we're seeing is that there's a lot of public fear, and it's grounded in really a lack of information. And so we're seeing many patients who really have a couple of questions. One, they want to know if they're going to get seriously ill suddenly and die. Number two, they want to know if they need a test for COVID. And number three, they want to know, okay, what symptoms do I watch for if I quarantine at home?
When someone calls you, particularly an elderly person, and worries that that person is going to become extremely ill from this, what do you tell them?
The majority of calls that we're seeing are from people that are younger that have symptoms that most of us, if it wasn't this pandemic, would think are typical winter respiratory colds, low-grade fever, cough, runny nose, sore throat. The issue is that those symptoms overlap with the same symptoms as COVID. And what I tell patients is that most of us will probably, or many of us will probably get COVID and not even realize it. We'll just think it's a winter cold, and the majority of us will do just fine. And really, the people that need to go to the ERs are those who have those typical respiratory symptoms, and then those symptoms progress to shortness of breath or difficulty in breathing. And so we give them advice about that. And we also talk about the need for testing. And for most patients, what we tell them is, you know, if your symptoms are in that minimal group right now, you're not having shortness of breath, whether you have a COVID test or not does not change the information and the guidance that I'm going to give you right now, which is to stay at home, self-quarantine, go to the CDC or other government websites if you're unsure about the best way to self-quarantine at home. We usually tell people you should do things like if you share a bedroom with someone, to sleep in a separate bedroom. If you have a second bathroom, try to use that bathroom. Do good disinfection of counter surfaces and those things. And then we give them guidance about what you need to watch for, and that being the increasing shortness of breath. And for those patients, you should come to the emergency department. Most people are pretty relieved when they hear that because they're just not sure. The experience that we're seeing in the emergency department is that the majority of the patients that are ending up on on ventilators are elderly, but we are seeing people in younger age groups that are very sick also. I'll tell you what's been the uplifting part of these conversations is that we're seeing many people that are younger generations that are sick. And they're telling me, you know, I don't want to go out and potentially infect older people. And I don't want my grandmother or my grandparents to be at risk. And so that part's been very uplifting to hear.
So that's positive, because we've seen so many stories, Rob, of kids going on spring break and being irresponsible. So it's nice to hear that younger people are actually thinking otherwise and trying to be more responsible. Let's talk about personal protective equipment, or PPE, a word that the general population now understands that used to be the purview of the medical community. We're talking about the masks, the gowns, the gloves that protect you and your team from coronavirus. Are you all getting the equipment you need?
There's not enough. And we have the equipment now, but we're worried that, as is everybody, that we'll run out. And so we started conservation measures that are safe, but they're psychologically taxing on the doctors and nurses that work. So some of the things that we've done are to cohort any patient that comes into our emergency departments into just one area of the ER, whereas before all this happened, you know, we have multiple teams and we have big emergency departments, and you could go to any part of the emergency department. Now we put all the patients in one area that have those symptoms. And in that area, our doctors and nurses wear those N95 masks that you're probably hearing about. And those masks are in short supply. And how those masks help is they help with airborne or virus that's floating in the air. And typically they're used for tuberculosis or things like that. COVID appears to be mostly droplet. So somebody sneezes on you, coughs on you, that liquid hits you and doesn't really hang in the air. But there are some indications that for certain things, it does hang in the air, like when we're doing an intubation or those things. So what we've had to do is to somewhat limit how many times we change out of that equipment. So you might wear your same mask with a face shield, for example, on the entire shift, instead of changing it multiple times a shift. We do change our gowns and other things, or if we get sprayed, of course we change. But that's something that we never had to do. We never had to worry about conservation. And to an emergency room doctor or nurse, it's an emotional drain. You're already in basically a spacesuit that you can only change out part of it. You're hot, you're sweaty. Yeah, everybody's concerned that, you know, can the supply chain catch up?
Has anybody who works with you, have any of your colleagues gotten sick?
Yes. So many of our people have gotten sick, doctors and nurses with fevers or coughs. They all get sent home. When COVID testing was available, they were tested. Some have been positive, some have been negative. The good news is all of our people who actually have been positive and sick are all better and return to work. Now, we've done some things. We do have some more senior physicians. We've kept them in parts of the emergency department where they're not exposed, you know, just knowing that most people that have a little more candles on their birthday cake are more at risk. But no, the good news is at NYU Langone here, every one of our doctors and nurses that's gotten sick has recovered just fine.
I want to bring up a question from a listener. Her name is Mary. She's a nurse. She doesn't say where she works, but she wondered if healthcare workers should isolate themselves from their families. I'm assuming even if they're asymptomatic, if so, how? Have you gotten such a question yourself? What are you advising your colleagues to do?
So one of the things is that, you know, just like the general public, you know, our colleagues in the emergency departments here in New York and across the country come to work every day, but everybody has their own anxieties about this. And so, for example, we've created the ability for people to shower before they actually go home, because they're wondering, am I going to spread something? Am I an asymptomatic carrier? I have people that I work with who have decided they have a little baby at home and with their significant other that they're not going to go home. They've got a friend's place to stay at who has a vacant apartment or those kind of things. All those questions we run by our infectious disease specialists. But I think, you know, a lot of people, even when they're doing the best practices at home, whether that's trying to keep a distance, even though they may not have any symptoms, they're still wondering. They're still worried for themselves and they're worried for their family. And so they're taking, whether it's appropriate precautions, extra precautions, yeah, people worry about those things and they try to keep some distance. When I do these video visits also, besides working in the ED, we do get people, another group that we're concerned about is if you live with somebody who's immunocompromised. You know, I've had people talk to me saying, you know, they can't get COVID testing as of today. That seems to be constantly changing the availability of public testing. They're concerned because someone they live with has multiple myeloma or some form of cancer. They're aware that those people are at an increased risk. And so they want to do the right thing, try to keep their distance, try to socially isolate, but try to do that while you're, you know, sharing a home with somebody. I've had people tell me they're living in their basement if they have a basement. So there's a lot going on as people try to keep each other as safe as possible.
When you think about the next few weeks, do you have any idea when this is going to peak?
No idea. I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm seeing sicker patients and in increasing numbers. I don't know when that'll level off. Our general approach is in that we need to be prepared for this to be a marathon and not a sprint. And so making sure that our doctors and nurses get adequate respite, making sure that we have relief physicians and nurses available should much of the workforce go down temporarily or have to go home because they're sick. So our approach is do our best on a day-to-day basis, but our eye is looking down the road. I always tell people that, you know, working in an emergency department on a regular day is like running a two-minute no-huddle offense in football, but for 8 hours. And now you throw in some uncertainty into that mix. It's like you're trying to do that in a swimming pool. But people that work in emergency departments are special. They have big hearts. They feel for patients and human suffering and are really up for this challenge. and just want to know, or just want to feel that there's support for them, and that support looks like proper PPE. And I will tell you that doing some of these video visits also has been uplifting, because so many times people have expressed gratitude for what ER doctors and nurses do. We're getting more thank yous than we normally do. We're seeing young people talk about how they're worried about older folks, and there's this multi-generational kind of commitment and kindness and empathy that's on display. So, we're all, as a nation, going through a lot, and we're all in this together. But I've seen some really encouraging signs of what the future looks like, and seeing a lot of people's inner kindness rise to the surface. And that makes me feel really good.
That was Dr. Robert Femia, chair of emergency medicine at NYU Langone in New York City. NYU may be managing now, but other hospitals around New York City, and indeed the country, are already struggling under the pressure of the coronavirus. In the weeks to come, I'll be continuing to reach out to those working on the front lines of this pandemic, and I'll bring you those stories here on this podcast, also on Instagram Live, which you can find by searching my name, Katie Couric, on Instagram. Up next, why wasn't this country better prepared? We'll talk with an expert whose job was to do just that. Welcome back, everyone. We're continuing our coverage of the coronavirus. This week, taking a look at pandemic preparedness from the emergency room to the Oval Office. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this.
Beth Cameron is the former senior director for Global Health Security and Biodefense. This unit, which was a part of the White House National Security Council, was established by the Obama administration after the 2014 Ebola epidemic. And it was intended to be a smoke alarm, a warning of the first signs of a global health crisis. In 2018, however, the Trump administration disbanded the unit.
The Office of Global Health Security and Biodefense was set up after the Ebola epidemic in order to get ahead of outbreaks before they become epidemics or pandemics. We were really worried coming out of Ebola. It was a hugely devastating outbreak that killed over 11,000 people. But we were looking at that as ultimately an event that stayed relatively circumscribed to three major countries. Of course, there were lots of concerns that it would spread more rapidly, and there was a huge global intervention that the U.S. helped lead to keep that from happening. But we were very worried about exactly what we're seeing now, a large-scale respiratory illness that would become a pandemic. And we knew that we weren't prepared for that as a nation or as a world.
Let's imagine a world in which that office had not been dissolved and you were still leading it, Beth. What role would it be playing right now in the midst of this crisis?
It would really be the best way to describe the office's role now would be as a coordinating hub. So the office was playing a role in working with high-level senior officials and sending information about problems and issues up the chain so that they would be resolved quickly. But also, really importantly, we were listening to staff at the working level across departments and agencies. So when there was a problem or a challenge or a need in the states or in another country, we were able to figure out, okay, what's the real issue? Who's not agreeing? And then elevate it really quickly.
You helped transition the incoming Trump administration. You directly briefed then Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert. Did you have a sense at that time the new administration was committed to the objectives of this office?
Yes. During the transition, I had quite a good experience with transitioning this specific office from President Obama to President Trump. And both the outgoing team and the incoming team, particularly, as you mentioned, Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert, had been through pandemic threats before in the Bush administration. And so there's actually quite a lot of support for continuing the role of this office. And not only from Tom Bossert, but also from National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, who I briefed before I left.
You said you were mystified when the Trump administration dissolved the office in May of 2018. Now, there seems to be a difference of opinion here with your op-ed in The Washington Post and someone within the Trump administration named Tim Morrison, who believes that your account was wrong. So tell me, as you understand it, what happened? Can you explain?
I can. And I think that Tim's op-ed was less of a rebuttal of what I said and more of an explanation of the organizational structure and what happened. So my understanding of what happened is that Tim Zeemer, who took my position as the head of the office, left the White House, and the people who worked on his team were dissolved and were moved into another directorate, the directorate that Tim Morrison ran. And it's definitely true that some good policies did come out of that office following the dissolution of the pandemic's team. But the difference, the critical difference, is that there wasn't a team or a senior level person whose only responsibility it was to handle pandemic threats. And that was something that, coming out of the Ebola epidemic, we realized was missing, that we were all focused on epidemics. We were all focused on the Ebola outbreak, but we didn't have a singular mission with a direct reporting line to the National and Homeland Security Advisor, where our job was only to focus on that issue. And it's like a transnational threat, like counterterrorism, like climate change. It's something that, when we see what's happening now, it's easy to understand why you'd want to have a singularly focused pandemics team. But when you don't have a pandemic happening, I can see how it would, how a national security advisor might look at that and think, well, maybe we don't need a team that's solely focused on this issue. And I just completely disagree with that. This is a lesson that lots of administrations have learned. So there have been senior level officials in the last couple of administrations focused on pandemic threats. And usually it's after an outbreak or a pandemic when that lesson is learned. And so one of the things that happened in the Obama administration is a couple of lessons came together. One of those lessons was that we needed a senior level official whose only job it was, with a direct reporting line to leadership. The other lesson is that we needed a team that looked at homeland and national security issues together.
When President Trump was asked about this, Beth, during one of the White House press conferences, he insisted he didn't know anything about that.
But you did disband the White House pandemic office, and the officials that were working in that office left this administration abruptly. So what responsibility do you take to that? And the officials that worked in that office said that the White House lost valuable time because that office wasn't disbanded. What do you make of that?
Well, I just think it's a nasty question, because what we've done...
Were you surprised at that? And who exactly was in charge of getting rid of the position?
I was surprised by that. I was surprised because there was quite a lot of press about getting rid of the office in 2018 when it happened. And there were a number of high-level people in Congress, think tanks, who wrote letters or spoke out and said that this was a mistake. So I was surprised that he wasn't aware. All I can say is that the dissolution of the office happened around the same time that Tom Bossert left, so right after he left, and right as National Security Advisor John Bolton came on board. And so I think this really was part of an overall restructuring, and a decision was made that this reorganization was a better organization for the White House. The White House gets to choose its organizational structure, but it's unfortunate that this lesson got unlearned in the process.
Let's talk about some of the warning signs, though, that existed for this current pandemic. Can you talk about some of the flashing red lights that we saw? Because there were a number of them, weren't there?
Yeah, there were a number of them. Going back to the beginning and watching the outbreak unfold in China, looking at a novel coronavirus that had the ability to spread between people, that was definitely something in our playbook of concerns, a new disease that could spread more quickly between people with a higher mortality. And I think the second that information became available, that would have flipped a switch for us to start meeting more regularly and thinking about what kinds of preparedness plans we needed to put in place or dust off in the United States.
And when was that?
That was in January when those cases really started coming to light. There was absolutely a bit of a delay in the world learning about this, but we did learn about it in January, several months ago.
I want to mention something even prior to that. According to the New York Times, there was a training exercise led by multiple federal agencies, 12 states, and private stakeholders that simulated a scenario where a respiratory virus dubbed the Crimson Contagion rapidly spread through the United States. What can you tell us about that? Because before we talk about January and February, let's talk about October.
Yeah, well, we can go back even further than October. We can go back to the transition between the administrations. So back in January of 2017, before the Obama administration left, there was a half-day discussion between the outgoing cabinet, the outgoing White House leadership, and the incoming team, the presumptive nominees for the Trump administration. And we looked at a number of homeland threats. And one of the small number of things highlighted for the incoming team was pandemics. So I was in that discussion and helped put that that discussion together. And there was a very robust conversation between outgoing officials and incoming officials about a respiratory agent. In that case, I think we were looking at a flu variant that could do something very similar to what's happening now. And then fast forward to a number of tabletops that happened outside of government, as well as the one highlighted in the New York Times, which actually I was not aware of that exercise and wasn't in government when it was conducted. But reading the reports of it, it looks eerily similar to what's happening now, and certainly is something that White House leadership should and would have been aware of.
So why do you think they didn't pay attention to that? I mean, the serendipity of that simulation is pretty uncanny.
I think a couple of things, just having gone through these exercises, they can, based on who's in charge of acting on what comes out, they either become playbooks for action and urgent action, or they become overwhelming and people don't know where to start to fill what is apparent now to us in the world is just a massive, massive set of gaps in pandemic preparedness. So all I can say is that this issue of pandemic preparedness should be funded the way that we fund military defense. It needs to be completely ramped up. It needs to include a massive lessons learned when this is all over. And I think, moreover, it's inexplicable to me why we haven't been able to act on some of the major recommendations that have come out of exercises throughout the last several months and years.
So when you dig deep and try to understand it, what conclusions do you draw?
I draw a couple. One is that it's really hard to imagine a scenario on the scale of what's happening now. And so we've developed many tools over the last couple of decades to help us with pandemic threats. One is our strategic national stockpile, which has been in the news a lot lately. Another is the Global Health Security Agenda, which is something the Obama administration launched to assist other countries to get prepared. Both of those efforts, and another is our Biomedical Research and Development Agency, BARDA, which helps advance medical countermeasures. These are massive efforts that different presidents launched, which when we look at them in retrospect, made a huge difference in our ability to deal with this crisis, but didn't go nearly far enough. And so I think part of it is when you look at the reports written about 9/11, it's a failure of imagination not to imagine what could happen. We're pretty good at that in tabletop exercises, but to actually get past the imagining and into the filling of the major gaps that we'll have to deal with in the worst case scenario. And I think that's been challenging for many leaders to wrap their heads around, including me when I was in government. But I also think that it's a failure of not having enough people in government whose day-to-day job it is to be thinking about those gaps.
I put out a note to doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, et cetera, to tell me about what they were experiencing. And it's heartbreaking. I just got a message this morning from someone who is a doctor in Louisiana who's already lost several colleagues to the coronavirus, who's writing her will. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to me, these young people who are working so hard on the front lines. And I don't want this to be a coulda, woulda, shoulda, but there has to be some lessons learned. I hope there's a commission similar to the 9/11 commission to look back on this. But what could have been done to provide to our most critically important healthcare professionals the protective equipment they needed? How could we have supported these people more and protected them?
I think it's an excellent question, and it's the hardest question to answer. I think right now it's very clear that we need a much more nationalized response than we currently have. And I think going back a couple of months, we should have been thinking forward about that nationalized response. So what I mean by that is right now we're seeing reports, and I'm hearing them too, talking to mayor's offices and people who are out on the front lines in the field, and they're cannibalizing each other. They're trying to buy equipment over top of each other. And the problem is that we have a system in the United States for responding to a pandemic that is built on what the states will request, and that's still the system that the federal government seems to be building its response off of. And this isn't a hurricane. Hurricanes are hugely devastating, but they usually don't affect all 50 states at once. And usually they don't continue for months and months and months. And so our system is built for providing and scaling up specific commodities and then getting them out quickly to the field, but not ramping up production continually for all 50 states. And so it's clear to me, at least at this moment, that we need someone in charge of the national logistics response, working with FEMA or maybe from within FEMA, but planning this the way we do a massive military operation. I don't mean to militarize the response in that sense, but using those tools that we have to transport, produce, and supply our country. And it doesn't seem like we've kicked that into high gear, nor that we were planning to do that a couple of months ago when it would have made a much bigger impact.
So what's the solution now? I mean, these people are desperate. They're reusing these N95 masks. They're trying to sanitize them. They don't have the equipment they need. How the heck do we get this equipment to these people pronto?
So I see two solutions, and neither of them are perfect, and neither of them are fast enough. But solution number one is that we have a national registry that starts monitoring where all the PPE is and brings together all of these great blooming initiatives that are happening out in the field under an umbrella that can actually match make much more effectively between states and entities that need personal protective equipment and other supplies the most. And that would require a real nationalized response with a logistics plan and someone in charge of it who knows how to plan, on the order of a military operation, somebody like the head of Transcom who does this for a living when we have a massive operation overseas. The other option, if that can't happen or won't happen or isn't agreed to happen, is that the governors could come together and decide to do this themselves. They could work with a coordinator on their own. They could work with the private sector, with Amazon and UPS and others who have logistics chains themselves to create a more nationalized system across the 50 states. And I've talked to a few people about that idea, almost an air traffic controller concept for the response. And I think that it's something that could work, but it would really need the right person and agreement from the states to do it. The other thing that really makes me frustrated right now, looking at the response, is that ideally what the United States of America does is we lead the global response, and we're not right now. And we should be making enough to staff and stock our own country, and then we should be shipping it and coordinating the response all over the world. And right now, we're one of the only countries in the world that can actually do that, even though it's hard to see that we can at this moment. We have the capability, the logistics capability, the production and manufacturing capability to do that, and we're not. We should make too many, and then we should staff the global response.
We'll return with Beth Cameron after this short break. We're back with Beth Cameron, who ran the White House Pandemic Office from 2016 until March of 2017. A year later, the Trump administration disbanded the office, a move that she says left the country less prepared for pandemics like COVID-19. What about these tests and the CDC? I mean, did the CDC just royally screw up? I hate to be so blunt about this, but did the CDC fall down on the job? What happened with this whole testing thing? Why weren't there enough? And why are there still not enough?
I think there are a couple of failures on the testing front, and I've done some forensics on this. There are other people that have too. I actually lay the criticism for this not directly at CDC's feet, although certainly there were some challenges at CDC in this as well. I lay it at the feet of leadership because honestly, when CDC realized that their test kit was going to have problems, yes, someone should have sent a flare up saying, hey, we have problems. Let's have a backup. Let's order the WHO kits. Let's put them through emergency use authorization so we can do that. But somebody else at HHS, in the government, at the White House, in leadership position should have said, look, while you're working on this test and perfecting it, we are going to create a backup because it is too important that we start testing now. That's not necessarily the job of the people manufacturing the test kit at CDC. It's their job to alert, but it's somebody else's job to say, okay, we're going to make the decision for you that this isn't the only test that we're going to have. And that's the kind of decision that the president, the vice president, you know, the lead for this pandemic in the White House should be bugging every day about. So,
and to go full circle, Beth, that's the kind of issue this pandemic commission would have been all over and on top of, because it would have been part of its centralized role to make sure that, you know, these things were taken care of in a very efficient, fast way.
That was exactly the reason that the office was created, to be able to get above the day-to-day challenges that people were facing, which are sometimes really hard to surface. As you know, when there's a problem, it's really hard for people at the working level to admit that the problem is great, especially if it's a problem that they don't usually experience. CDC is usually quite good at creating excellent test kits and diagnostics. When they have a problem, somebody should say, look, you're having a problem. That's okay. We're going to help you solve the problem, but we can't wait for you. That's leadership's job.
And finally, Beth, there's been some rumblings and indication that the administration is weighing the cost on the economy with the cost of on public health and human life, really. That there is some drive in the White House, ostensibly led by the president himself, to try to take a look in a couple of weeks to returning or making efforts to loosen the guidelines and mandates and to get the economy going again.
So I think Easter Sunday, and you'll have packed churches all over our country. I think it would be a beautiful time. And it's just about the timeline that I think is right.
This is against the advice of, I think, universal advice of public health advocates and officials and experts. Can you weigh in on the rumblings we're hearing about that?
I don't even think it's just the public health experts. I think it's every credible person that I've talked to. We can't relax these measures, and it would be bad actually for the economy. I mean, if we weren't even thinking about the huge toll on lives and the at-risk and the elderly, if we even put that aside for a second, this would be bad for the economy because until the caseload comes down, until our hospital system stabilizes, until we have a steady supply chain for all of the things we've been talking about, personal protective equipment and reagents, test kits, et cetera, until all of those things get to a stable level, if we turn people back on and send them back to work, we'll see increasing spikes, crashing healthcare system. People will then not go to work, or they'll be sick, there'll be confusion, and ultimately the economy will tank again. And it might even be, I'm not an economist, but I surmise it might be worse because it will be even more unpredictable how that will happen across the country. So I think it would be a terrible idea to relax these measures right now when they're actually starting to make a difference. There does need to be hope, though, for the American public and for the economy. And I think that hope is letting the social distancing do its job, watching the case counts start to fall the way that they've fallen in other countries that have done this, and then massive testing so that we know who is infected and ultimately also who has been infected, so that people can be isolated on a case-by-case basis, and the people that don't have the disease or who have recovered from it can start getting back to work. And I think that's what we have to be looking for, and we have to have specific fact-based measures that drive us in that direction. But we're definitely not there yet.
It's fascinating to the science of this virus is so complex. And are you optimistic that the scientists studying this that are working so hard on developing a vaccine, who are trying to identify the antibodies that some people have naturally to this virus, that science will come up with some answers relatively soon?
I'm optimistic for sure that we're going to get there. I think most of the experts I trust, including folks that are out at the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, which has been looking at coronaviruses and vaccine candidates for coronaviruses for a while now, I'm optimistic that we'll eventually get a vaccine, but it will probably be 12 to 18 months. I am optimistic that we'll eventually get to some therapeutics that might work for some individuals, and hopefully we'll get to some therapeutics that work for the elderly and for other at-risk populations, because that's where if we can help identify a few things that work, that would be even just to make it less deadly, even if it still has a terrible course in some people. I think that would be helpful. I am optimistic. But I think we're in this for months until that point, and certainly at least a year for a vaccine.
Well, hopefully this terrible chapter in our history and in the world's history will provide some lessons learned. I have to believe that we will look back and try to get a handle on how we prevent this from happening in the future. That was Beth Cameron, currently the Vice President for Global Biological Policy and Programs at the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And that does it for this episode of Next Question. I know a lot of this can be tough to hear. These are indeed scary times. But if we do our part, if we heed the experts' warnings and stay home and find virtual ways to connect, we can get through this. In the meantime, to lighten the load, I'd like to highlight an act of kindness. You might remember last week I asked you to share the good deeds you've seen or experienced during these dark times, and we've gotten some really touching ones. I'd like to share one message I received from a listener named Lee Stewart, who lives in Bristol, Virginia.
A couple of days ago, my brother and I had to leave our 89-year-old mother alone in the ICU of the local hospital because it had to ban visitation due to the coronavirus. Of course, we totally agree with the precautions, and even she understood that they were necessary, but it's so difficult, especially when right before I left, she clasped my hand and said, "I don't want you to leave me." However, her nurses have been absolute angels. They have adopted her and even fixed the FaceTime on her phone so that my brother and I can chat with her. So every afternoon, one of the nurses holds up the phone and calls us, and we are able to have a nice long talk with our mom. And just really see how she's doing, and she can see us. That gives her a lot of comfort. We can't even describe how grateful we are for these medical professionals who are not only using their medical knowledge on the front lines of this crisis, but who also are providing a conduit of compassion that enables families like ours to stay together, even though at times that's only in a virtual way. Thanks for your hard work and inspiration during this crisis. And thanks so much to the RNs and other medical staff who are both warriors and angels during this time.
Thank you, Lee. We wish you and your family well. And of course, the same to all of our listeners. You can keep sending your moments of kindness. I think we could all use a dose of the feels. Just leave your name and a detailed message at 844-479-7883. Again, 844-479-7883. You can also email me at info@katiekirk.com. Just put kindness in the headline. For the most up-to-date information and guidance on the coronavirus pandemic, please visit the CDC and the World Health Organization. You can also check out our morning newsletter, Wake Up Call. You can subscribe to that and get everything you need to know every morning in your inbox. Just go to katiekirk.com. We'll be continuing this special coronavirus coverage on Next Question for the weeks to come. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Until next time and my next question, I'm Katie Couric. Thank you so much for listening and stay safe, everyone.
Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartRadio and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are Katie Couric, Courtney Litz, and Tyler Klang. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Our show producer is Beth Ann Macaluso. The associate producers are Emily Pinto and Derek Clements. Editing by Derek Clements, Dylan Fagan, and Lowell Berlanti. Mixing by Dylan Fagan. Our researcher is Gabriel Luser. For more information on today's episode, go to katiekirk.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Katie Couric. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.